from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump has vowed to close the border with Mexico this week unless the Mexican government stops caravans of migrants coming to the U.S. from Central America. This weekend, the State Department also announced a plan to cut off aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, countries that the president accused of deliberately sending migrants to the U.S. Meantime, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee will vote this week to subpoena Special Counsel Robert Mueller's full report. We'll take up both of these stories with political analysts after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump has threatened to close the southern border this week as surges of migrants continue to arrive at the Mexican border. Trump says he'll close the border if the Mexican government doesn't stop migrants trying to reach the U.S. from Central America. And the State Department announced a plan this weekend to cut off aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. The president has accused those countries of deliberately sending migrants to the United States. Meanwhile, the House Judiciary Committee is expected to vote this week to subpoena Special Counsel Robert Mueller's full report. And joining me to discuss these stories and more, Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington Desk for NPR News. And good morning, Ron.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Always good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. I guess the place to begin is with the southern border. President is saying, I'm not playing games, threatening again to close the southern border, at least large sections of it. The real question here is, how much should we take this threat seriously? And secondly, how serious is the threat as he is putting it? I mean, we're getting word that there are indeed migrants in numbers that we've never even seen before.
That is true. There are thousands every day, and the numbers are overwhelming the Department of Homeland Security, whether that's because they failed to prepare or because they could not have anticipated the volume of the arriving migrants. Probably some of both is true. There certainly has been a certain amount of effort made to dramatize the emergency at the border or dramatize it as an emergency and to dramatize it as something other than a humanitarian crisis. As we just heard a moment ago in the newscast, the Pope has been referring to it as such, and suggesting that countries have to deal with migrants at their borders in a humane fashion. But in our country, the reaction to the arrival of these migrant trains has been, to some degree, to criminalize them, to say that they're being sent by criminal gangs and that they are, in some sense or another, an invasion of the United States. So the Trump administration has taken a very hard line and has now decided that Mexico is not doing enough to halt the migrant caravans from the Golden Triangle countries that you just mentioned, and that we are now going to cut off aid to those countries, which was intended in the first place to improve conditions so as to discourage people from leaving in these migrant fashions. And, well, all of this is bringing the president to a point where he is renewing his threat to close the border utterly and saying that he's not playing games. I believe he said that because he has threatened to do this before without actually following through.
Yeah, and I want to follow up with you on what it would mean, indeed, to close the border. But at this point, President López Obrador of Mexico says we're fighting smuggling. We've been willing partners in this whole migration hordes that are coming, as they're described by President Trump, invasion, as he described it, as you said. And at this point, we also have the president not only turning his wrath against Mexico, but also against, well, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
Just in the past week, officials of the Department of Homeland Security have been in Central America, participating in a conference, signing off on a document, trying to cooperate with those countries. And the president has now kind of pulled the rug out from under that approach and said, no, we're just going to cut them all off, punish them for sending these migrants. And perhaps the president has concluded that these countries are deliberately doing this to bedevil him. But the Mexican government has been highly cooperative up to now in trying to stop the caravans, doing what they could to settle them in southern Mexico and other parts of their country, and also just to cut down on the amount of abuse that happens to these people as they cross the Mexican landscape. So It is not clear how the president expects this to change the situation, but it certainly does raise the temperature, and it certainly does appeal to the people who were at the rally in Michigan on Thursday night, hearing him make this threat, saying he was going to close the, quote, close the damn border, unquote. I think some people have a somewhat unrealistic idea of what that might mean, because as you know, this is literally the world's busiest international border.
Well, we've got about a $1.7 billion trade deals that come across the border, and there's a threat to 5 million jobs. There's a great deal at stake here.
Yes. Well, $1.7 billion every day, Michael. It's $600 billion in the course of a year.
Right.
That's more than half a trillion dollars. But you're absolutely right. $1.7 billion every day. And approximately, although nobody knows exactly how many, about a million people cross that border every day. A million people going in one direction or the other. A number of people go back and forth for work. Many of those people are U.S. citizens. Many of those people have legal passports. We are talking about the traffic that goes on every day. And to close that down entirely has been done a couple of times briefly right after 9/11. President George W. Bush did it. And we have seen a couple of other emergency situations. But those were situations that were going to be addressed and resolved. They were not cases of the President of the United States making an ultimatum to other nations that they change their behavior, or we were just simply going to keep the border closed, quote unquote, permanently. That's the president's language.
There is some confusion, though, Ron. I'd like to go into this with you just for the moment, and then we can turn back to the effect that this will have economically and on lives and cross-border sections particularly. And I do want to talk with you also about what's going to be happening with Congress and the Mueller report. But I'm interested in the fact that, for example, the Mexico Interior Secretary warned that this would be the mother of all caravans coming toward the United States. And yet we have, for example, Honduras Deputy Minister saying there's no indication of any such caravan.
There does not seem to be much agreement on whether this problem is getting worse or whether it is a steady state of people arriving. The numbers that we have been looking at are something like 2,500 people a day. That's a huge number in terms of daily arrivals who are migrants seeking asylum. It is, of course, only a minor fraction of the total traffic at the border, but people arriving in places like El Paso and San Antonio and so forth have overwhelmed the resources of the Department of Homeland Security. They don't have places for these people to be. They've been trying to get people dispersed once they're processed into other communities, but they literally, as I understand it, exhausted the resources of the Greyhound bus company and others who were taking folks to other parts of Texas and other parts of the country. So folks are just basically camping out in lobbies and parking lots and waiting rooms, waiting for their chance to move to other parts of the country.
And we're talking about the latest news from Washington with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Olivia Nuzzi joins us as well, White House correspondent for New York Magazine. Welcome, Olivia Nuzzi.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And let's talk with you a little bit about the impact of this on the cross-border and particularly the humanitarian side of it. I mean, a lot of people seeking amnesty, and the president has characterized that as a big fat con job, to use his words.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think it should come as any surprise to anyone who's observed this president since before he got into politics now that he has a lack of empathy when it comes to this issue. But I think that some of his language has lately been a little shocking, even to close observers of him. It doesn't seem to have registered with him completely that, you know, not besides being the commander-in-chief, besides having all the responsibilities and the powers that come with that, he also should be trying to lead in a moral sense. And I don't think that there's anyone around him currently who would have it in them to try and convey that to him. And I don't think that there's anyone around him who, even if they did say something like that, who he would listen to.
Well, you're talking about his lack of empathy. I'm sorry, you're just talking about his lack of empathy. There is and has been a great deal of emphasis on the humanitarian side of this, and that's understandable. At the same time, many of those suffering from contagious diseases, they'd be put in detention centers, and that'll only worsen. That's the way the argument goes from the other side. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, I think we could look at specific cases. There was a young girl who died recently the report said she would have been visibly sick for hours beforehand. And if you hear those interviews with agents on the border, they're very concerned, and understandably so, that, without enough space and proper facilities to hold people who are coming across the border, you can spread disease very quickly. It can become a very bad situation very quickly. And I don't think that the White House or this administration really has a plan in place for, how to house people who are coming across the border. And if they're going to keep detaining more and more people, what to do with them so that it does not turn into a health crisis.
And Ron Elving, you were talking before about the effect that this would have on trade and on cross-border activity and so forth. It would also impede a lot of U.S. citizens. I think you alluded to that, who move back and forth across the border. But there are many manufacturers who depend on Mexico, and this would have a great deal of a political effect. In fact, I was wondering, in terms of political effect, about what you thought of President Trump in Grand Rapids Thursday night talking about the Mexicans stealing automobile secrets.
Yes, the president frequently acts as though our trade with Mexico is a one-way street, that Mexico takes and the U.S. gives, and the U.S. does not benefit at all from that trade relationship. He says they take our money. This is a direct quote. They just take our money and talk. That is a characterization that he has put on our trading relationships with some other countries as well. And in this particular instance, the president has negotiated with Canada a new version of the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's called the United States-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Agreement. And that is actually, it doesn't have the word trade in it. It's just USMCA. But that agreement, the president is pleased with, supposedly, although it hasn't been ratified by Congress yet. The president is supporting it. It really isn't that different in any fundamental way, but the president doesn't characterize the new agreement the way he has characterized NAFTA in the past, as he said in Michigan on Thursday night, a very one-sided and they just take our money and talk kind of relationship. So I think people who are actually in business realize that trade back and forth across the border with Mexico, $600 billion a year, is very much a two-way street. And we are getting things from Mexico that we want, and we are selling things to Mexico that they want and that we want badly to sell to them, such as agricultural products, and we are bringing agricultural products to them. We sell a lot of meat in Mexico, and those relationships have been quite healthy and quite beneficial for both countries.
Do we know if the administration's closing the border would include air travel at this point?
We don't, but theoretically, if you are going to close a border, and I don't think the president is necessarily contemplating this, it seems unlikely, but if you are going to close a border with a country, you would not be allowing airplanes from that country to come across the border either. That would be another form of crossing the border. Although I think most of the focus here, certainly in terms of the president's rhetoric and the narrative that he tries to create here, is focused on ground transportation.
And Olivia Nuzzi, let me go back to you, and let's transition to talk about what's coming up with the Congress and the president, or certainly the Congress and the judiciary. In terms of subpoenaing, in terms of moving forward, it seems like the Congress is intent on getting a fully redacted view of the Mueller report, and there's a lot of talk about what redactions are going to be in that report. It looks like we're headed for a battle royal here. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think that Democrats in Congress, understandably, believe that they should see the full report, believe that they should not be, hindered by a ton of redactions. And the president, although the White House had said that he supports seeing the report and he has no problem with the report coming out, I assume that when we start to learn a little bit more about what specifically is in the report, the White House may change its tune about the redactions. I can't imagine that. I was talking to a senior White House official last week who said that they were very concerned that the president was going overboard with declaring victory based on the Barr letter, because they are certain, the senior White House official, that there will be negative details in the report. And when those details become public, they don't want the president to have to backtrack or look ridiculous And they're worried that the report will be negative for him in the end. So there's kind of a faction of people in the White House, you know, the kind of cooler heads who are emerging to say, why don't we calm down and wait to see what is actually in this report before we declare victory. And then you, of course, have the president out there kind of waving a flag, very excited, and seems like he can't be reasoned with on that issue. But I do think it's going to be a big fight, about what specifically the public and Congress gets to see.
Is it fair to say, Ron Elving, that the Democrats think, particularly because in that four-page report that came out of the Attorney General's office, Richard Barr's office, that they think there may be an obstruction case here and they want to get at it, and they also want to maybe even subpoena Barr himself because there's been threats that maybe they're going to accuse him of some kind of a cover-up?
It is fair to say that the Democrats are hoping that there is more in the report to explain why Mueller said he could not exonerate the president, but then William Barr said he could, that he could say there's no reason here to think about obstruction of justice, and there's no collusion, and Mueller apparently did not make a case for collusion. But let's also remember that the standard of proof that you are dealing with, if you're Robert Mueller, is the standard that says you must go to court and prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. Not that there might be something here, not that there might be a little smoke, not enough for, say, a pretty good story in a newspaper or a television program, but a courtroom beyond reasonable doubt for a jury. That's a high standard, and it's a standard that Robert Mueller no doubt took seriously. So what people want to see is, what did he have that he did not think met that higher standard, and what do we think of it from the standpoint of Congress, which may have a somewhat more, let us say, accepting standard of what would be adequate evidence of the president's misconduct. Then there's the whole question of obstruction, where Mueller was not willing to exonerate the president, where that's quite clear. Mueller even is quoted in the Barr letter saying that. So people want to know, and yes, Congress will subpoena William Barr if he does not willingly come forward already on his own to explain why he thought that his four-page summary, and he doesn't want to call it a summary, his four-page report on the 400 or nearly 400-page report from Robert Mueller was adequate.
And Congress feels that it has the right, indeed, to pursue obstruction and to find out, indeed, if there are culpability grounds with respect to obstruction, correct?
The underlying policy here for the Justice Department is that the president cannot be indicted, that all the Justice Department could ever do would be to produce a document that would be a kind of roadmap for Congress if Congress wanted to remove the president from office through impeachment, and if Congress then exposed the president to indictment by doing so. This is what happened in Watergate 1974. The special counsel in that case, who had taken over for the fired special counsel, produced a roadmap, which was then followed by the House Judiciary Committee in proceeding against Richard Nixon.
And Olivia, if I could go back to you, the president could, I mean, theoretically, could insist to see the report and use executive privilege. But according to the AG, that's not what he is indeed intending to do.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to me. It seems like once the president received Barr's once he received the report, his interest in learning more kind of evaporated. It doesn't seem like he wants more information than he already has. And you can understand why that would be. If in the full report, as I said before, we stand to learn some negative things about the president. We stand to learn some damaging details. So it makes sense that his level of interest is slim compared to the level of interest in the media and the public and among Democrats in Congress. But it doesn't seem like he is particularly interested in reading the full report. And I think even when it does come out, I wouldn't be surprised if we were to learn that the president was briefed on it, but did not read it in full himself.
We're talking about the latest news from Washington with Olivia Nuzzi. She's White House correspondent for New York Magazine, and Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and we do invite your participation in the conversation. I'd like to hear from you if you have thoughts about the two stories that we are focusing on now. We'll bring up other things as well. We want to hear what your thoughts are, and we want to hear any questions you may have. So feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have concerns or thoughts or questions about the possible closing of the southern border or about what's going to happen with the Mueller report and the 400-page report, which is now a four-page report from the Attorney General, We'd like to hear from you. Again, toll-free number you can join us at now is 866-733-6786. And you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And another story that, and let me go to you on this, Olivia, that certainly is shaping up now and needs to be at least given some serious thought to, is a whistleblower who's come forward and told the House about systematic security clearance problems. It's getting a good deal of attention because Patricia Newbold, the employee, actually sat for an interview with the House Oversight Reform Committee on March 23rd. And this is all about Trump administration simply moving security clearances forward without necessarily going through, well, the process that they should have gone through, plain and simple.
Right. Well, yeah. There's kind of been a drip on this issue for over a year now. You'll recall after Rob Porter, the staff secretary in the White House, left following allegations of abuse last year, but I think that was in last February, last March, we learned a lot about the White House security clearance process and the way that certain people were allowed to serve in positions where they were present during top secret meetings and receiving lots of information that perhaps they shouldn't have without clearances or with temporary clearances. And since that time, we've learned a lot about Jared Kushner's clearances, other officials in the White House, but it has kind of come as a drip. And so I think that this is yet another installment of that. It is something that I think the president and the White House need to provide some answers on.
Ron Elving, another big news story, and I don't want to necessarily give a whole potpourri here, but I know listeners want to respond to individual news stories, so I just want to bring up one that has gotten a good deal of attention, and that is Joe Biden, who is not necessarily a candidate yet officially, nevertheless being charged by a woman who ran in Nevada, Lucy Flores, not with sexually doing anything, but with doing things that she felt uncomfortable with, invading her space, kissing her, putting his hands on her shoulder, and so forth. What kind of traction is this going to get, do you think? I mean, it's getting a lot of attention now, but like I say, he's not even officially a candidate.
No, and perhaps this is the time to have this discussion about Joe Biden. Some people have called him Uncle Joe in that sort of affectionate way, but that term can also have a double meaning. It can imply a touching or a familiarity or something greater than that from a, say, relative or somebody who seems avuncular and non-threatening, but who uses that very status to sort of be too touchy and be a little too much in your personal space. And that is something that Joe Biden has done for as long as anyone who has known him in this town for very long can remember. He was elected to the United States Senate in 1972. He was here for Watergate. He was here for Ronald Reagan's era. He was here for, to his regret these days, the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings, which he chaired and which were a blot on his record as a supporter of women's rights because he did not do well by Anita Hill, and he has said so by his own admission. So all of these things are kind of coming back in this moment before he is at the moment of decision, if, or at least the moment of announcement. Most of us expect he will run, and one of the things he's going to have to answer for is his very old-fashioned and perhaps troglodyte attitudes towards how men and women should relate to each other.
All right, on that troglodyte note, again, I invite our listeners to join us. Lots to talk about the southern border and security and the future of the Mueller report. Also, Uncle Joe brought that up as well, and security clearances. Join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. If you'd like to join our conversation, we invite you to do that. We're talking about the latest news from Washington with Ron Elving of NPR and Olivia Nuzzi of New York Magazine. And you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And here's a tweet from Corrine, and I'll go to you in this, Ron. Writes, isn't the threat of closing the border less about caravans and more about the 2020 presidential election and keeping Trump's base riled up?
There is that viewpoint that the president is quite intent on keeping his base riled up. The rally in Michigan on Thursday night is an excellent example of this. Michigan is a state that was absolutely critical to his winning in the electoral vote in the Electoral College in 2016. He needs it again in 2020. And he's going to go back there into Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the other states that put him over the top with extremely narrow margins. So he is going to try to keep that base riled up. We have seen this kind of attitude in his crowds where he takes them out to a brink of frenzy where, for example, talking about the Mueller report after having basked in his own interpretation of what the Mueller report might say, he then said that the people responsible for there being a Mueller report in the first place, the people who started the investigation, should themselves be investigated. And the crowd began to chant, lock them up, lock them up, lock them up. So the president does know what he's doing when he brings up things of what might strike other people as unrealistic or extreme nature in front of a crowd such as that.
He's backed off to some extent, though, at least in his criticism. We don't hear him talking so much about witch hunt or hoax as we did beforehand, because, he even called Bob Mueller an honorable man, which was a bit surprising considering all that he tossed at Bob Mueller previously.
He did respond to a question in the White House from a reporter who said, do you believe Robert Mueller has acted honorably and or done an honorable job? And the president thought a moment and said, yes, I think he's acted honorably. And I think at that point, when he was assuming that everything in the report was good, he certainly had every reason to admire and salute that report.
Question, Olivia Nuzzi, from a listener named David. Does the president have the legal right to close the border with Mexico? Olivia? I'm sorry.
Well, if he wants to try and issue an executive order, suppose he could do that. But I think that we've seen how Congress reacted when he attempted to use an executive order to fund construction of a border wall there. I think it was one of the first instances where we really saw some Republicans push back on him. And so I think if he does do something like that, then there stands to be a big fight in Congress and even among some of his supporters here in Washington. But I did want to just say, I don't think that it's accurate to say that the president has not been using words like witch hunt as much anymore since the Barr summary has come out. I think he's been using much of the same language that he always used. You talk to people in the White House who work for him, I think that they are even more intense in the language that they used over the last couple of days than they were even before the Barr letter came out. And I don't really see any change in tone or in rhetoric on this issue.
Well, one thing that seems to have diminished is before the report came out, there was a great deal of talk and carried a kind of scathing indictment about those making up the report who did not get any votes. In other words, these are people who were appointed as opposed to elected, and the president was trying to use that as a kind of leverage, I think. And we haven't heard much of that rhetoric now that the report has been released.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a kind of irony in the president, dismissing the Justice Department, dismissing Mueller before the report came out. And now I think, he's more open to accepting the results of the Barr letter, at least, if not the Mueller report itself, and instead of dismissing them outright. But I do think that that he seems less, he seems just as intent on calling it a witch hunt, saying that the whole premise of the investigation was silly, was incorrect, it shouldn't have happened, we should investigate the investigators. All of that is still true today, and I think even more true in some cases than it was before the letter came out.
And again, Olivia Nuzzi is White House correspondent for New York Magazine, and our first caller is you, Ethan. You're on the air. Good morning. Ethan, are you there? Going once? Okay, let me get another caller on then, and that's Nikki. Nikki, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my question is that I understand Schiff and Nadler are going to subpoena both the Mueller report, and I guess the Gang of Eight supposedly is able to see the intelligence information. But what if he says, no, sorry, the administration's shown that pretty much they're going to say, take a hike to almost anything. So what then? Does it just go to the courts for another 2 years and then you potentially get selected?
It's a relevant question. And Ron Elving, some thoughts from you.
A highly relevant question. What seems more likely than an outright refusal to share the nearly 400 pages is that the version of those 400 pages that will be shared by William Barr, the Attorney General, will be so highly redacted, and we've already been told it will be redacted, that Congress throws its hands up and says, this is ridiculous. This is so far from being the full report. We understand that there are some things that cannot be released to the public, they will say, but Congress is a little different. We get to see even the things you don't think we get to see. So the battle into the courts, and it surely will go there, will be over whether or not William Barr has properly redacted the report or not, whether he's gone too far. He has said he will redact anything that needlessly harms third parties who are innocent parties. And, of course, we expect that he will also redact anything that is covered from a section of the law that covers grand jury testimony. So if it was testified to in grand jury and not corroborated anywhere else and hasn't resulted in a charge, that needs to be redacted, and he has a strong case there in the courts. But for some of these other things that he says he's going to redact, that I think we're going to see a fight over.
Especially peripheral third parties, maybe, who would be harmed?
That is what he said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me go back to you, Olivia Nuzzi. The listener just mentioned Adam Schiff, and Adam Schiff is actually, there's an attempt, I would say, I'm not overemphasizing this or categorizing it incorrectly, to purge him from Congress, particularly from what they are calling an abuse of power from the House Intelligence Committee. And President Trump has asked him to resign his House seat. Does this have any real mobility behind it, any real power behind it? I mean, aside from the president also talking about his neck, I don't know what that was all about.
And the president's son also used his name to turn it into an expletive on stage at that rally in Michigan last week. I don't think it really does. I think it would be, highly unlikely that this would have any real-world result. But I do think that when the president of the United States and members of his family and members of the White House, who also have significant platforms, are attacking anybody this way, tensions get heated. We've seen how contentious fights in Washington can be. We've seen them having real-world results over the last 2 years or so that the president's been in office. I think it's always a little bit concerning when one person is singled out this way. But whether or not it's going to have any effect, whether or not it's going to result in him resigning or being pushed out of office, I think that's highly unlikely. But it always is a little worrying, I think, when the full weight of the White House is being targeted in one direction at one individual.
Let me bring another caller on here. Stephen, that's you. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks, Michael. Great show. So I had two questions. First, Attorney General Barr cited Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E regarding information from grand jury proceedings as a basis for redacting information from the report. It's my understanding that there's a judicial procedure to go to court to get a judge's order allowing for the release of that information. Do we know whether the House Judiciary Committee can go directly to court, or whether they need the DOJ's participation in that?
Thank you for the question, Stephen. Let me go to you on it, Ron Relving.
One thing that the Judiciary Committee would normally do would be to issue a subpoena, and that subpoena would then have to be enforced by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who is, of course, an employee of the Department of Justice and therefore an employee of William Barr. We have seen this kind of fight back in the Obama administration with Eric Holder and the Republican Congress. So that would be one procedure. There may be another way that parties, maybe the House Judiciary Committee or one of the other committees or the Speaker of the House or someone could go directly to court and thereby bypass the subpoena procedure that would have to be enforced by the U.S. Attorney and the Department of Justice. Those are some of the avenues that we're going to be pursuing if the normal means of doing this breaks down, which it has not as yet. William Barr says he's going to cooperate, just not as soon as the House would like. The House has set tomorrow, April 2nd, as their deadline. Bring it over. You've got it. We want to see it. You don't have to redact it for congressional use. Just bring it over. And the attorney general has refused to do that. And now they're talking about voting on subpoenas on Wednesday. So the fat is pretty close to being in the fire at this point. And this week, we should begin this struggle between the branches that will clearly have to be resolved in the courts before we get too much further, so that we can find out how much of this report Congress sees and then how much we all see.
And Stephen, you said you had two questions. Did I hear
you? Yeah, the other one, quickly, like in civil, I'm an attorney in civil litigation. When we withhold documents on the basis of privilege, we have to produce a privilege log that identifies the date and nature of the document and the basis for the privilege. Do we know whether or not we're just going to get a totally redacted report without any sort of specific citation for the basis for any particular redaction? Or is it just going to be like just page after page of black bars?
You want to tackle that, Ron, if you would?
Let me just say, I do not know the answer. I do not know whether or not William Barr is going to take the redaction to the max, or whether he is going to struggle on and err, as he promised in his confirmation hearings, and err on the side of transparency. We haven't seen much effort to err on the side of transparency thus far, but that is what he promised. So we're going to wait and see what the actual product is. But frankly, just for my personal opinion, I would be surprised if this document is not extremely heavily redacted. That is what I think we should expect.
And by the way, if you would like to join us in the time remaining, it's 866-733-6786, toll-free. Here's a tweet, Olivia Nuzzi, from a listener named Lanny, who says, I read somewhere that Barr intends to let the White House further redact the report on the basis of executive privilege. I don't think that's the case, is it?
No, the most up-to-date reporting I've seen on this said that the president, the White House, is not going to review this beforehand. I think that could change, but at the moment, it seems like he's just going to be delivering this to Congress, and the White House will see it when the rest of us see it.
And another question, if I may, to you, Olivia Nuzzi. LaWanda writes, can one of your guests please give a brief summary on what is being investigated by the Southern District of New York?
Well, my understanding is that a whole slew of things are being investigated in the Southern District, including the inauguration, the Trump Organization, and various associates of the president and of his campaign. Of course, we'll recall that it was based on Robert Mueller's recommendation that Michael Cohen was investigated in the Southern District of New York, and we all saw the results of that. And so I think there's a tendency to think about the SDNY as being kind of completely separate, and it is, obviously, but completely separate from the Mueller investigation. But all that we have to do is think back to Michael Cohen and the results of that to remember that there is a lot of overlap there between those two different bodies.
I also like to remind listeners from time to time that the Southern District of New York, just like the AG's office, is technically under the executive aegis.
Right.
Something that I think we need to bear in mind. Provocative question, Ron Elving, from a listener named Charles. He says, what are the similarities of Barr's cover-up of Iran-Contra to his hiding of the Mueller report? I like the language there, very telling, but your thoughts?
We don't know yet, and I think we need to keep reemphasizing this, just what William Barr is going to do with the rest of all of this. We only know what he has done with his initial look at the Mueller report, and of course, he saw it all. He has it all. Nothing has been redacted from William Barr. We know that he was not persuaded that this was something that the president could be prosecuted for in terms of obstruction of justice, if the president could be prosecuted. And we do know, this is a very important thing we know about William Barr, that last year, better part of a year ago, he sent an unsolicited letter to the Department of Justice saying that he thought that the Mueller investigation was ill-conceived, that it probably shouldn't exist. And this was at a time when Rod Rosenstein was running the department. He was the deputy to Jeff Sessions, who had recused himself from anything having to do with the Trump campaign. And that, of course, was very upsetting to the president, who eventually fired Jeff Sessions, probably for that very reason. But in the meantime, William Barr, more or less, if you will, auditioned his point of view on all of this by sending this unsolicited letter. And now that he's in this position, he seems to be carrying forward on his general attitude of what he thought about the Mueller report and what he thinks about executive privilege. So that would hark back to some of his previous actions when he worked for the Bush administration and when he was in the Department of Justice in earlier times than that, back into the 1980s, as the caller suggests.
No, forgive me, Ron. We should add the fact that during the hearings, he certainly offered some very different kind of data in terms of his position.
He promised he did not promise total transparency. He said he would err on the side of transparency and wished to be as transparent as possible. But I think you have to take that in the context of everything else he has said and done.
We'll get another caller aboard here, and that's you. Uday, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. The question is, the Barr's report says no coordination with the Russian government. Does it mean coordination with the Russian oligarchs or cutouts doesn't matter?
I think, a pertinent question. Some thoughts from you, Olivia Nuzzi? The oligarchs as opposed to the government, some do not separate the Russian oligarchs from the Russian government and Vladimir Putin, to be sure. But what do you make out of that, Olivia?
Right. Well, I think that, that, as you said, some people do not separate those things. And so the investigation, at least to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, but the investigation was looking into specifically the Trump campaign's potential collusion with the Russian government. So that would include any oligarchs or individuals like that who were associated with the government. But beyond that, I don't know whether or not Robert Mueller was just investigating individuals in Russia who were not tied to the government, who may have coordinated with the Trump campaign.
I suspect there is something in the Mueller report along those lines, wouldn't you think, Ron Elving?
There are two formulations you could put on that language. One is that he is responding, William Barr is responding, to the exact language of the charge to the special counsel, which did speak of the Russian government, not just anybody who happened to have a Russian name, not just anybody who happened to be a Russian citizen. And so he is responding in a formal way to his formal charge by using that particular language. The other thing is to be a little more suspicious about it, as the caller implies, that perhaps the Russian government did its work with Donald Trump through intermediaries. And we do know that there were people who were involved in the interference that is, by the way, questioned by no one, the Russian interference in our election of 2016. The only question is, how much was the Trump campaign involved in it? There is clearly interference, and some of that was sponsored by individuals with close ties to Vladimir Putin who are not actually members of the Russian government.
Question from a listener named Matt, who says, any chance we'll know why each word was redacted? It would be nice to know the logic behind each redaction, given some reasons are more legally sound than others. And that question came up in a different form before, Olivia Nuzzi, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Right. Well, I think that, Ron, you answered this before, but we don't know whether or not there will be explanations for the redactions. I think, and this is just my best guess, but I think it seems highly unlikely that we will have an explanation for every single redacted word. But I would certainly like that to be the case. I want as much information about this report as possible, and I think every reporter and every American probably feels the same way. And I think it would be nice if we did have an explanation for each redaction, but I don't know that that will be the case.
And a question from a listener named Daniel, if I could go to you, Ron Elving. Daniel says, am I naive or is it too simple to call to Mueller and ask him if he agrees with Barr's 4-page summary letter?
Robert Mueller has not been forthcoming to respond to inquiries of any kind about this special investigation since the beginning. There have been a couple of times there were notes sent out from his office, as it were, saying, no, that particular report in BuzzFeed is not reflective of what happened, or it does not actually report on what we have in our evidence, but very carefully parsed, very carefully stated. Robert Mueller has really avoided becoming a character any more in this than he absolutely has to. The president, of course, has made him one again and again and again, very highly personalizing it, calling Robert Mueller a Democrat. Robert Mueller is a lifelong Republican, and famously so. But the president has really gone after him in those terms, and he has never fired back in any terms. I think we have to assume that Robert Mueller figures, eventually, he will be, in some sense or another, testifying somewhere about all of his work, whether it's in front of an open hearing of Congress or a closed hearing of Congress or on television or somewhere to a biographer or possibly in a court, possibly in a very high court of the United States, asking him a lot of probing questions about how he did his business. So he has, up to now, been as silent as the Sphinx.
And I wonder, speaking about silence and the Sphinx, if I could go to you, Olivia Nuzzi, about a thought with respect to President Trump saying he has total exoneration, going against essentially the language of the Mueller report. But there have been some polls. NPR PBS poll recently said only 36% of the public really feel that the report clears the president of any wrongdoing, and there's broad support for release of the full support. So what's the impact of that kind of, indeed, if these polls are accurate, of that kind of public concern and response?
I think there's only so much that you can claim, you know, the sky is red when it's blue and have people be on your side, right? I mean, the Barr's letter specifically quotes the Mueller report as saying, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. That is pretty clear. And yet the president continues to use the word exonerate. And I think, you know, in conversations I've had with White House officials over the last week or week and a half, they kind of bend and they contort to try to make it seem like the president's not just misrepresenting what the report says on that specific issue. And they say, oh, well, basically I'm paraphrasing, but oh, well, he's using exonerate in kind of a more spiritual sense than you're using it in a literal sense right now. And I don't think that people buy that. And I think also people know by now that Donald Trump oversells everything. You know, that is what he did professionally before he was in the White House, and that's what he does now. It's all marketing, and I think that that is why you don't see, you know, people falling for what he's selling on this issue and having that reflected in the polls. So it doesn't surprise me, but I do think it's kind of a relief that people are not so easily fooled by his marketing.
So where do you think, in the short run even, Ron Elving, this is going to go? I mean, particularly where Congress is concerned with the subpoena power it has now and with Speaker Pelosi talking very tough talk, one has to ask the question, what's going to happen without trying to read the tea leaves?
In more normal times, one would expect at this juncture there would be negotiations. The White House, Barr's office, people in Congress would sit down and have some discussions of how they can sort through all this for the purposes of pleasing the public, which, as Olivia has said, overwhelmingly wants to see this report and wants to see it all. So how do they deal with that? Everybody wants to respond to that. Everybody wants to be on the side of the angels and the side of transparency. But those negotiations, as far as we know, are not actually taking place. And the White House's attitude appears to be, and this may not be William Barr's attitude exactly, he is going to stand on the safest legal ground that he thinks he has, thinking about the courts that he expects he will have to answer to. The White House, on the other hand, would prefer to go with this, hey, it's all great, it's all been wiped away, the cloud has been lifted attitude. That's a little different, and it's going to be a little hard to reconcile and very hard to negotiate. So I expect that the subpoenas will be issued on Wednesday. I don't expect that William Barr will change his own timetable. He will go ahead with his plans to wait until the mid of April to share a redacted version. He's going through it, one assumes, rather painstakingly. And supposedly Robert Mueller has been involved in that. So we'll see. We will see some version of it. Congress is almost certainly not going to be satisfied with that. And the negotiations that probably ought to take place are probably not going to take place. And we will see the collision go off to the courts before we see a really satisfying version of this full report.
Again, Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And Olivia Nuzzi is White House correspondent for New York Magazine. And Olivia, I want your response, if I could get it, to a comment from a listener named Bernie who writes, the press should focus more on the inaction of Congress than the actions of President Trump. While Republicans have been largely acquiescent to President Trump, Democrats have been largely void in new ideas in terms of our immigration and trade policies. And in this vacuum, the president, and not Congress, is setting national policy, which is the opposite of what our Constitution says it should be.
Well, I take that point. You know, I think it's very easy because the president sucks up all of the oxygen in the room to just focus on him when there are a lot of other things going on in Washington and the country and in the world. At the same time, I don't think that Congress is getting very much done or is capable of getting very much done. And he is the person who is kind of setting the agenda for what we're all talking about and what we're all focused on. And he has a great deal of power as president and has been attempting to use that power to change policy. And so I think we could do a better job of multitasking. But at the end of the day, I do think that the president, like it or not, is the biggest story in American politics right now, and he's going to continue to receive a lot of attention, especially as we go into the presidential election.
And we started out talking about the president and his response to at least threatening to close the southern border. And Ron Elving, what do you think is going to happen there?
The president will probably attempt some kind of a show closure or a short shutdown, something like some of the previous government shutdowns we've seen, not so much like the 35-day government shutdown that we've seen. The president surely knows that that shutdown did not help him, did not help his approval rating. And so I think he will be judicious about using a somewhat shorter period of shutdown in order to try to make his point and then back off. There really is no practical way to shut that border down for any extended period of time. It just wouldn't work. It would not be legal. It would not hold up in court. And the destruction that it would wreak on people's lives and on the economy would be substantial.
Let me get a final caller in, and that's you, Connie. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. Very briefly, I just wanted to hearken back to Adam Schiff's response in the Intelligence Committee meeting last week. It was so spot on. I am an independent voter, but if I were in the Democratic Party, I would begin printing T-shirts that say, I don't think this is okay.
Okay. A marketing idea. Actually, I think that Adam Schiff got a lot of support from his own fellow party members. Would that be fair to say, Olivia?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they're printing up T-shirts or anything.
No, I don't think they have.
But I think he does have quite a lot of support, and I think it's always in the Democrats' eyes when it comes to Donald Trump a good thing when one of their own gets under his skin enough to become kind of a recurring talking point. And I think that they would prefer that the president be fighting with Adam Schiff than be going after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or one of the 2020 candidates, which he's not really doing as much.
Well, we'll leave it there, and I want to thank Olivia Nuzzi and Ron Elving for an important hour of information and thoughtfulness. Thank you, Olivia. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Ron. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And listeners, good to have all of you with us as well. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Another hour is coming up, and stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.